Hello, and welcome to today's webinar on an excellent new book from the Alliance for Excellent Education's very own Tom Murray. I'm Deb DeLisle, President and CEO of the Alliance for Excellent Education. Thank you for joining us today. And Tom, thank you so much for being here with us today and for writing this wonderful new book. So awesome. Personal and Authentic, Designing Learning Experiences That Impact a Lifetime. To our audience, if you're tweeting about today's webinar, please use the Authentic EDU hashtag that you see in the bottom of your screen. Before we start, Tom, I have to admit, I went through two boxes of tissues in reading this book. I started, I stopped. It resonated so much with me, and I saw myself and my kids in this particular book. Sometimes I thought my heart would just absolutely pop out of my chest. I just was so moved by your words. And I learned more about the experiences that have shaped your life, and I have come to truly respect you, not just as a colleague, but also as a friend, on this journey together on education. Thank you for sharing the moments in your book. I did bring another box of tissues along the way, and I'd suggest to our audience, when you pick up this awesome book to read, that you end up having a box of Kleenex by your side as well. So, Tom, people say not to ever judge a book by its cover. I pick up this book. This is one of the most visually appealing covers, and I'm a very visual person. It just resonates with me. I'm the kind of person who walks to a bookstore and says, I'm interested in this. Talk a little bit about the reasoning behind this and why it was so important for you to have this on your cover.
Well, thanks, Deb, and it's such an honor to be here today. It's such an honor to call the Alliance for Excellent Education and Future Ready Schools home, so it is great to be here, and thanks for the opportunity to talk a little bit about Personal and Authentic. You know, when you look at the cover of the book, I really wanted to create some imagery, or have imagery created, I should say, that spoke to the heart, as you see that, but also reminded educators. You'll notice the fingerprints on them. Mm-hmm. So when we're thinking about personal and authentic, really diving into how do you visually represent something that's personal and authentic? And just like all of our fingerprints are unique, the impact that we leave as educators on the children that we serve is unique as well. And so it wanted to create this visual imagery to help educators and remind them why we do what we do, but their authentic impact is really on generations to come. And it starts with the cover that you see in the book.
Yeah, it's amazing. And for those of you who can look closely at the cover when you get to the cover of your book, you'll see there are two fingerprints, and they intersect so much so that they do create this heart. So I'm just so excited that that was such a visually appealing front cover. And designing learning experiences that impact a lifetime. Talk a little bit about that. What led you to this particular strength and talent that you have?
So one of the things I know about educators is they just go and they go and they go often until they have nothing left. And, you know, I brought myself back to my first year teaching at 21 years old, thought I had a clue as to what I was doing. But I'll vulnerably share, there was days I would head home with tears in my eyes, wondering if I was having that impact. There was days I would head home wondering if I was just making that difference. And working with so many educators through Future Ready Schools around the country, you know, sometimes I know they question that, you know. You know, we ask educators to seemingly do more and more every year with less and less. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to give them that firm foundation reminder of the impact that and the privilege that they get to have in working with kids. And so in creating Personal and Authentic, I think the visual imagery did that as a starting point. But to really create a book that reminds educators why we do what we do, mm-hmm. speaks to the heart a little bit.
Yeah.
It's a different book in the essence of sharing some of my own personal experiences, but also taking some of the everyday life experiences and relating it back to ultimately why we do what we do, and that's serving kids.
Yeah. One of the wonderful things I would suggest about the book, and actually I believe firmly in it, is the style of writing that you have. We talked a little bit about this mm-hmm. before, and you were talking about your prior book is very much formal writing, if you would say, having been a language arts teacher. Mm-hmm. And then when I read this, you just capture people's hearts in reading it because of the informality. Is that a difficult style of writing?
Yeah, you know, this book was actually a lot easier for me to write. Learning Transformed, as you referred to, co-authored with Eric Scheninger, with ASCD, it's a very different book. And I will start with the audience is meant to be different. Sometimes in working with the district, they might say, you know, should I buy Learning Transformed for every teacher? And I'll actually say, like, understand that that's not the audience. It's a much drier book. It's much more researched practice. Mm-hmm. Michael Fullan called it a blueprint for systems. systems change.
No tissues needed.
Yeah,
right?
No. There's not that heartfelt story. And so, in terms of from an author end, this was actually an easier book for me to write because it's telling stories, and it's really putting myself back in that classroom, or times as a principal that I just messed it up and made a bad call. And so sharing story is a lot easier to write than pulling lots of contemporary research and trying to pull it in to make recommendations. And so I really enjoyed writing it. I will say, as you mentioned, it does tap a lot of emotion. There were many days I would write it about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'd be there, and I'd go into a Starbucks, and I will tell you, I'm over there in the corner, and I'm having a coffee, and I had some tears streaming. And just like many educators have already reached out sharing the impact that it's had and touching their heart. I will tell you, as an author, it really brought me back to some emotion, and it brought back to some of the things that I could relive going back to being that first year teacher and having some of the things happen, or, you know, the stressors that we had as a principal or when I was at district office, and relive some of that. And so in writing the book, I think the power of story is what came out. And it's really what people relate to.
I was particularly captured right from the beginning because your introduction is very powerful. And it's written by Inky Johnson, a well-known name to many, although maybe not in education circles. So why did you ask Inky to write this when he's not very well known in the education field?
Sure, thanks for saying that. And, you know, people have asked, it's interesting you didn't start with a foreword from an educator, and I will actually say it was really intentional. When I look at Inky Johnson's story, and for those of you that don't know Inky Johnson's story, I encourage you to check out Inky Johnson's story. For me, it was, I wanted to, if I was going to have a foreword, and I debated for a long period of time, but I wanted to have a foreword from somebody whose life experience was very different than mine. You know, anytime I write a book, I recognize that it really comes from my lens, my personal experience, but I fully recognize the vast differences of other people out there. So Inky is somebody, he grew up in a two-bedroom home in one of the most difficult areas outside of Atlanta, 14 people living there. And he grew up completely poor, and he would go out to the bus stop on certain days and actually shake out his backpack to make sure that there was no mice or rats from the night before he got to school. And so, you know, in getting to know Inky and hearing his story, the where I share it, it's not just here's some story, it's about the impact of a teacher. And so I led with that forward because to this day, Inky will talk about his teacher saving his life and his teacher intervening and saying, Inky, you're better than that, and calling him out when he needed to. But it was a teacher that picked him up for school every day of his high school to make sure that he was there, that would shoot hoops with him and do those kinds of things, that eventually walked his wife down the aisle at Inky's wedding.
Isn't that
and
amazing,
so
right?
Starting out, I wanted to show people the impact that we had. And so although Inky's not an educator, he's not giving educational advice. He's talking about, here's somebody that made a difference in my life, and that's something I want teachers to walk away with.
And that's what's so incredibly difficult as an educator. So often we think, well, we don't know the impacts that we have. And it's very powerful when you hear stories, when somebody reflects back on somebody, an adult in their life who mattered, because that adult may or may not know it, right? So I always encourage folks to go ahead and send a note back to somebody who mattered in your life. And that introduction really is a tribute back to that teacher who, according to Inky, saved his life, but also probably served as a great role model for Inky to pay it forward, if you will. And it sounds like your lesson about that is really critical to teachers. So talk a little bit about that and this whole focus on relationships and why it matters so much.
And the personal and authentic framework that I created, relationships are really at the heart and center. You know, it's no secret when I was a teacher, when I was a principal or a district office or working with educators today, it is really difficult to have a profound experience with a child if there's a poor relationship there. And so, you know, whether it's Inky's story and hearing about that relationships or that's working through Future Ready and just seeing the impact that we have, it really does come down to that relationship. You know, when a child knows that you believe in them and will do whatever it takes, it doesn't mean having that great relationship doesn't mean we sugarcoat everything and just get them by. Sometimes it's calling them out. And so, you know, I can think back to a mentor that had done that for me. And that relationship really is at the heart and soul of why we do what we do. And one of the things that I wrote in the book is that I really believe if we become more concerned about what we teach before who we teach, we've lost the purpose in the work. And
Powerful
it
statement.
Doesn't minimize content. It doesn't minimize standards. It's all important stuff, but it never will become before who we teach.
Let's talk a little bit about that. I was so interested at the beginning of the book when you introduced us, all of us as readers, to the mentor you had, whose name I believe was Mark. Can you talk a little bit about Mark? It's a very powerful story in one. I would reach into this little box of tissues because... While it's a very sad portion of your life, it also sparked just your heart in a different kind of way. So talk about the importance of Mark as your mentor And then the eventual influence it had on you.
Sure. When I think about Mark in my first year, one of the things I was just so incredibly blessed to have an amazing mentor. And what I mean by that, it wasn't just, here's your next packet, here's the next thing you're teaching. Mark called me out when my mindset was off. And I'm really encouraged when I look back at having somebody man-to-man. We're the only two male teachers in our elementary school where we were. At one time, it was October of that year, and I shared this story in the book where my mindset just wasn't right. I walk into my faculty room, I totally lose it. I had a rough morning over this one child, and you know, I blow up in front of all my colleagues, and I lose it, and I, you know, this kid's not getting it. The mom never calls me back, and I really go into the entire thing.
Sounds like a sort of a poor me.
It was, and to be honest, in retrospect, now that I can look back, I was 21 years old. I'd been teaching for only a handful of weeks, and so my skill set really wasn't where it needed to be.
But you had a license, as I did.
You know, and there's just so many lessons from that first year, and certainly some good things happened. But I realize in retrospect how limited my tool belt was and having some of those things. And, you know, my mentor, Mark, and one of the stories that I share in the book, followed me out of that faculty room, and I didn't realize at that point in time, opens up my door, and there I was at my desk, I had just totally lost it in front of my colleagues, and comes over and reads me the riot act of, like, we don't act like that here, and we don't do that, and really called me out on it. And I will tell you, it was a turning point for me, even early on, of recognizing, number one, here's a mentor that's calling me out saying, like, we don't do that here. And ultimately said, maybe it's you that's the problem. And, you know, when I found out the things that I had found out months later about that individual child, like, it was such a humbling feeling recognizing I'm so focused on me and my rules and my expectations that I couldn't see him. And so when we look at the heart of that child, when I understood why that child was acting up the way they were, it completely put in perspective of my worries and my fears. Just getting to school on a given day was a colossal accomplishment for that child. And yet I was worried about some pretty low level stuff in that child's life. And so to have a mentor to call me out and say, like, we don't do that, but set me straight, you know, is something that those educators on the whole, and I don't know, people in general, don't really like that conflict. And I think many times, throughout my career where I would look the other way, or maybe as a principal where an issue would address, and I'm not one that loves conflict, but I will tell you, there's times where we need to address it one-on-one and just say, hey, we're not being professional when we talk like that. We gossip about that colleague. We don't do that here. And I'm fortunate to have a mentor that that did that for me.
You know, what's really fascinating about the story and quite interesting to me is that when Mark approached you, even though you say he called you out, to me, he did so in a very loving and caring kind of way, right? He could have just said, just let him walk out, or he's never going to make it. Or he could have dismissed you, right? Or thought, there's that uppity 21-year-old who thinks he knows everything. On the other hand, he didn't let that slide by, and he saw great potential in you. So he invested a piece of him. But think of the language that he was using. Like, we don't do that here. So there's this very much this culture of collegiality, which is so important. But right after that moment in time, you again grab the reader by the throat and by the heart, most especially, and talk a little bit about what happened later on with that student that, again, was a deep blow to your own heart in your, and just really required you to be completely humble.
So about a month later, you know, we were still grieving the loss. The in that case, we were building up to, as you know, later that spring. You know, see, Mark was the kind of teacher kids ran to. He was the kind of teacher that kids would come back and visit all the time. But later that spring, Mark passes in a car accident, and driving down, and I was one of the last people to say goodbye. And I will tell you, and it's hard not to get emotional sharing about it, but, you know, those quick interactions in those moments and sharing with Mark, and you see the impact of a teacher, 4,000 people. And sometimes people say, really, 4,000? And that's roughly what they estimate. It took hours and hours just to be able to pay your respects to my mentor.
And probably grown kids, students who had grown up and now returned as adults.
And, you know, he was the type of teacher, and you see so many amazing teachers out there that they're not just amazing at school. He was so well known in his community. There were so many things he ran in the township. So he was known everywhere that he went. It was the type of person that he was, you know, but losing a mentor, losing somebody that I really wanted to be like, was a real challenge for me. And, you know, I will tell you, there was days where I closed the door and you have these 9 and 10 year olds looking up at me thinking, where's the person across the hall? And for some of them, it was their first real loss to somebody that they were used to and saw.
And you don't learn about that in teacher school?
Right, no, absolutely. And I will tell you, just the grieving process with my colleagues. You know, I remember that day coming in after the accident. Mark had lost control of his brand new RV. And that day, just coming in and loving on one another as colleagues. And, you know, nobody talked about what we taught that day. It was about people. It was about relationships. It was about loving on kids. It was, you know, it was pulling together as that team. team. And so the emotion is still raw when I talk about it, just because of the relationships that's there. And, you know, every one of us has dealt with loss in some way, family, close friend, you know, and it never gets easy by any means.
Yeah.
But I will tell you, it's part of my goal is helping his legacy live on, because he was a life changer. And, you know, being able to share part of his story and his impact in his book almost 20 years later is something that I'm proud to do on his honor.
And not to be undone by challenges. Fast forward a little bit of time, and some other tragedy enters your life. And I know that it's hard and raw to talk about it, but can you share a little bit about it? Because, again, it grabbed my heart right away. Like, okay, things are going to get a little bit happier in your story and your travel along being an incredible educator, but that didn't happen.
Yeah, so about a month later after Mark had passed, we were still mourning. You know, it's not like you just flip the switch and you get over it quickly. We were doing this one assignment in our class, and it was on who do you admire. And so the story that I share in the book is, you know, for me, I was finally getting to a point, because here I was 7 or 8 months into my career. Finally, I'd had some great parent interactions, some good things happen in the classroom, and feeling like just maybe I could do this teaching thing. And so we're doing this who do you admire, and I was going through, and I was so proud of my kids. They had worked so hard and just with such detail, and some of them talked about a mom, or someone talked about a coach, or those things. And I get to this one.
Remind me again, before I'm going to interrupt, what grade level reminder?
It was fourth grade.
Fourth grade.
Yeah, so I get to this one, Cody, and he was one, we had some struggles in our class, and but he had written about me. And I will tell you, at a point where part of it was my model that I had written for the class, I wrote about Mark, and I wrote about how I admired him because kids wanted to be in his class, and he was a veteran of 26 years, and he knew what he was doing, and he called me out when I wasn't thinking well. And Cody had written about me. And so I teared up the moment that came, and it was all about not what I taught, but it was about the relationship that we had, that he came to school because he knew I believed in him, and that when he came to school, he knew that I would help make him smile. And this is a child that had a difficult past and a difficult upbringing. So I was in service day the following day, and I hear the Tom Murray, if you're in the building, please come to the office. And so my heart just didn't set right. It was just kind of this weird, like, why am I
sinking feeling?
And so I walk out of Quakertown High School. There I was. I walk second floor, and I walk out, and a district administrator is standing there and looks me in the eye, and I kind of get this feeling of like, oh no. And her words are, so something's happened. It's not your family. And I remember feeling like, I can't do this. Like, I can't do this. So I get walked down, and the superintendent, assistant superintendent folks there, and I can still visualize where people were in the room to find out that morning, Cody had passed away. And I will tell you, one of the pieces that I write in the book, but is if I just had one more chance, if I just had one more opportunity, you know, they ruled his death accidental in that regard. And I'm not going to get into details. I only share in the book what was made public in newspapers. But I will tell you, it's one of those that I really wish I could have. I really wish I took, you know, extra time. And, you know, I think naturally when we have losses like that, sometimes, and we see things throughout our country all the time, you know, you have this natural guilt of, well, maybe I could have, or maybe I could have. And I will tell you, I never had the chance to hand that back to Cody.
Yeah.
And it's one of my regrets kind of in education, but I think it propels my passion of looking at it. And then when I was a principal, having gone through some of those pieces, one of the stories I didn't tell in the book, but only a number that was in May, and then that September, having grown up in New York, I lost three friends in 9/11, and so that was a 6-month stretch that I will tell you was the lowest of my life. And looking back on that, it really gave me a foundation of, if I can get through those pieces, what's going to come at me as a principal that I can't handle, or you know, those other things. And not to minimize other issues that came along the way, I will tell you it was a really difficult time in my life. But as I reflect on it, it made me who I am today and some of the work that I want to lead, but it also helped give me a lens on seeing people first and not just getting caught up in the content and standards first, which again are important, but not more important than the people.
I just feel so much for why it resonated with me, particularly because you know, when people will say, so if I reference my role as a superintendent in a school district and I loved those kids and I loved our team, you know, folks would say, out of all the experience I've had, what's the most meaningful for you? And I go back to that time and they'll say, well, what were some of the really difficult times? And it was when I had to face children dying.
Yeah.
And I remember one week in which 3 children in the school district died. And again, you know, I said, teacher school doesn't teach that, neither does leadership or superintendent school, because that's about the lowest you can get. And when you see a family grieving and breaking that cycle of life, it's just so difficult. So you can see I'm moved by your book and reflecting that again in my own experience. I always think about culture. And so I've been in the business for more than 40 years. And I certainly adhere to the adage that, you know, culture eats strategy every day of the week for lunch or breakfast, whatever meal it wants to eat, right? But one of the things I really like, and you talk about a little bit here, I'd like to expand upon it a bit, is the you have four core pillars of culture strategy. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I really wanted to pull together, and again, doing a lot of this type of work around future-ready schools and creating environments that people want to be. One of these ideas is this first idea around leadership. And sometimes we look at leadership by title, and that's something Eric and I addressed in Learning Transform. And it's helping teachers to see that, you know, some of the greatest people that I've ever worked with that were the most dynamic leaders are those people that were teaching in classrooms every day, those support staff members that were making a few dollars an hour above minimum wage, had a backbone to our building. And so around this first piece being leadership and recognizing their own leadership in the classroom, it is so easy in our work to point the finger and just say, well, if my principal would, or if this person would, it's so much more difficult to look at here. And so it's helping people to reflect on, well, how do you lead and how do you make those decisions? How do you empower others for kids to be able to lead?
Right.
This other idea in creating it is around interactions and helping people understand that every interaction really matters. And I really believe when we talk culture that every interaction either builds culture or tears it down. There's really very few neutral interactions. And so helping people appreciate those quick interactions. And so out through the book, I reflect on just some really quick, sometimes even 30 second or less things that had happened that I can remember 20 years later. Mm-hmm. And why is that? And helping them to understand the interaction, sometimes that quick interaction student to teacher can even be a life changer for that child and not to lose sight of that. But then I also talk about risk taking and trust. And so trust is really the foundation of all those pieces, whether it being in a classroom or leading a building or leading a district. If your students don't trust you or if your teachers don't trust you as a principal, and so creating those four to help create that culture to ultimately go back to that risk-taking so kids can take risks or teachers can take risks or principals can take risks. And so whether you're talking the highest levels or a superintendent or even in the classroom level, it's all very relevant.
I noticed when you talk about trust and this whole level of trust and even being a professional, you also talk about self-care and its importance. That has not been my priority, so I'm going to get lessons from you as well, as should our viewers. Talk a little bit about self-care, not just about the importance of it, but I'm hoping you can give us an example of how you practice self-care.
Yeah, and so I will actually say I'm not good at it either. It's one of those that I think I tell people, here's what you should do, but don't do what I do. And I think it gets to the heart of, you know, the nature of people that are educators, we have this servant heart, but understanding that giving and giving and giving, often until you have nothing left, puts you at a point where that you can't be at your best when we need to maximize our effectiveness. One of the analogies I make is, you know, as humans, we won't go to bed at night without recharging our phone. Like, God forbid we have a phone that's not charged the next day. But we do that all the time as educators. We'll go months without recharging ourselves.
Great analogy. So, thank you.
And so I make the connection to trust. It's like we've got to trust ourselves enough to make sure that we can do those self-care pieces, like leave the laptop at school or not answer emails over a weekend or whatever it is, because this work is so emotional. This work is, there's always something to do. There's always more that can do. There's always lessons you can improve, that there's a point where we need to find ways to shut it off to make sure that we don't lose our family in the process. We don't lose our health in the process, to ultimately be able to maximize those examples when we need to in our classroom. And educators have such servant hearts that I think it's difficult for them to shut it off at times because you give and give and give. But doing whatever it takes for kids does not mean you go until you have nothing left.
I'd also suggest that the importance of that, Tom, is there's a price to be paid when, as an educator, you feel you have to know all the answers. And you carry that burden when you don't know the answer, or if I've tried strategy A, B, and C and it doesn't work, begin to internalize that rather than reaching out to you just the way Mark reached out to you and say, I just can't get this, but there's a vulnerability there. Have you felt that ever, that vulnerability, and how do you overcome that as an educator when you don't have the answers? I do think that that impacts your mental well-being.
Absolutely. Right? You know, obviously, it's being competent is a non-negotiable. We have to be competent in the work, but I think people relate to vulnerability. It's why throughout the book I share so many times that I failed, so many times that my mindset was off. In fact, I don't believe I share one single story what I would say I'm trying to pat myself on the back, because I wanted to be vulnerable throughout the book. And what I've found in working with thousands of educators is that, you know, when somebody's standing up front saying, oh, look at me and look how I did it, and you come up with every reason you can't. Well, if I had that principal, if I had that superintendent, if I had that PTO, if I had that budget, you make every excuse you can't. But when you're vulnerable and you just put it out there, you find people saying, there was a time my mindset was off, I lost it too. And so that connection lets people let their guard down, and then you can just be real. And one thing throughout the book that I really wanted to be is just real. It's not your top down, you know, you need to do these five things. It's just, let's be real as educators, but not lose sight of the impact that we get to have.
I remember one time when I was teaching sixth grade and I'd planned this science lesson that I thought was going to be the most fantastic thing. And on the very first day, a student named Michael threw his books down and told me it was irrelevant. And I had to make a split-second decision, because I could have gone and just said, okay, out of the classroom. We're going to plow ahead with this because you know how much time I spent? And that would make the kids feel really bad and guilty, right? Or they wouldn't have cared. But I had to step back and just say my response to that was, okay, I'm going to be vulnerable here and say to kids, so what are you interested in learning about and tell me why? And we went off in a different direction. It ends up being a great a lesson because we ended up being guided by kids at that particular point. But it freed me a little bit to be vulnerable to my kids, yep. Not just to the adult peers around me. That's really important too.
And the bottom line, I think, you know, educators, we're wired, and I know biologically this is incorrect, but we're wired to be perfectionists. We want that lesson to be just perfect because it really comes from having high expectations in and of ourselves. But at the end of the day, if our kids see us as somebody that knows it all, doesn't make mistakes, has all the curricular areas mastered, they can't relate to us because they don't know what that feels like. And being vulnerable, and I think it's just as important, if not even more important, with leadership.
So we've known each other for several years now, and I come to respect you more and more every day and working closely now with you at the Alliance. One of the things that really resonated with me right from the beginning of hearing about this notion of, I'm going to use air quotes, which I don't love, but hidden stories. Yeah. And those are woven throughout this wonderful masterpiece of a book. Talk a little bit about the hidden stories.
Sure. So I was actually coming to work one day down here in D.C., and I take the train down as part of it. And somebody tweeted out, that's one of the best videos I've ever seen. And I clicked on it, and I had no idea what it was. And it's this video on hidden stories. And it comes from Franklin Covey. And so in the video, it's about a 3-minute video. And there I am sitting on a train. I watch this video. There's no words throughout the entire video. And 3 minutes later, I look up, and like I've got tears flowing. And there's like people that kind of look, you doing all right? I'm like, no, I'm good. Just watching a video on the internet. And so what it is you see these everyday interactions with people. You see this, they go into a convenience store. Then you see somebody in like a pharmacy, but they don't talk, but you see what's on their heart. Mm. And so you see this, you know, gets to spend the entire day with her granddaughter. So you can tell she's excited. But then inside the pharmacy, you see, you know, just found out the tumor was benign. But then you see the next one, just found out the tumor wasn't benign. And you see people's hearts in the process, and it ends with this really emotional piece around, like, if you could see into the hearts of people, how would you make decisions? Would it just be your average day? So part of what I wrote about is my daughter's own story. And so, again, try not to be emotional on that end. So one of the pieces that I often throw out there, thrown with district leaders is, you know, take this data at face value. So here's a child that missed 35 days of school in 15 months, where it's tardy 20 times. What are the judgments that we make? And, you know, I was guilty of these judgments too. It's probably parents don't care. The kids are unresponsive. Why don't they care? Their kid's lazy. They don't want to be here. And, you know, we make all these judgments, and then I'll show the next slide and say, well, I just talked about my daughter, and the whole place kind of comes
like,
to a stop.
What?
Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Like, how could that be? You do this education stuff. How could you let your child?
Sure.
So then you tell the story, and I share how in a 15-month period, my daughter, who had been hospitalized 3 times for less than 1 seed of sesame because of such incredible food allergies, to 15 months later now having 2,000 seeds a day. And I share, well, here's the context. On every one of those absences, she was 2 hours from our home undergoing food allergy therapy, and then we drive 2 hours back, and on every one of those, she would say, Mommy or Daddy, I really wish I could be in school today. Mm. You know, out of 19 of the 20 times she was tardy, it was because we had a 7 a.m. appointment 2 hours away, and we could get her back to school by 1 o'clock. But the moment you know the context of the story, your judgment changes. And so part of what I wrote there is I really believe the difference between making a judgment, like we always do, and having empathy is understanding the story. And so part of using my daughter as an example there, she couldn't show back up at the school building not having that on her heart. So she would go in, and I'm so blessed to have that she had 2 amazing teachers that weren't, here's the 5 things you missed this morning. They saw her as a person first and recognized, like, the last thing I want to do is just dump it on her, and here's what I'm going to do, and understood her story before they tried to make judgments on it. And so to help educators, you know, when we look at that child in our classroom that has spent more time in the hallway in the past week than in our classroom, like, what's the why there?
Yeah.
And so often we put Band-Aids on it, or we take it so personal, there's a reason behind it. Or we look at that colleague that's constantly negative and everything's awful and everything. Well, at one point in time, some principal looked across the table and said, that's the person I want. And so what happened there? There's a story there.
Yeah.
And so trying to help us as educators get to the heart of the story, because the story matters every single time.
Mm-hmm.
And we take something like the data is certainly important, but data without understanding the context of the story, and we can make some really bad decisions. And so connecting that video studio, which really spurred my thinking on that, to my own daughter's world of that's a hidden story. If she were to walk in the studio right now, it's not something that you could see in her, mm-hmm. but it impacts her every single day. Mm-hmm. And it's how do we as educators make sure that we have that lens on things yeah. as well?
Well, what's also important that you just shared is kids can also be great teachers to mm-hmm. us, right, Ellie? So I'm sure you would have been empathetic without having to go through what you yeah. went through with or continue to go through with your daughter. But here she taught you the valuable lesson or kind of put in yeah. your face that understanding the context of a situation is really vital. Because as you say, in the throes of a very busy, hectic day, it's easy for an educator to say, you know what, he doesn't care, I tried, she didn't learn it, parents don't care when they may not know mom, dad, auntie, yeah. grandma has two or three jobs just to live in that school district because they're making a choice for the future of their children yeah. or their grandchild, right? So I think that's really so critical. And again, it's not necessarily, at least in my training, it was not covered in teacher school, yeah. but it came through people who said, get to know the stories first, get yeah. to understand the context, get to know your kids, and the rest is all going to flow, right? Yeah. So I just think that that's really a really important lesson. So for me, when I was reading, chapter 5 was absolutely so vital within the book. And in it, you write about authentic and experiences for kids, mm-hmm. with emphasis on the word authentic. Yeah. So share a bit about that and how sure. you interpret that and advice you'd give to educators to practice authentic teaching and learning.
Sure. So one of the things that I did is, you know, in running so many workshops and professional learning type days through Future Ready and those kinds of things, we often talk about how do we make learning personal? How do yeah. we make it authentic? So I really tried to identify what are tangible ways that we can do that. And mm-hmm. through it, I create this framework around things like looking at the social emotional side of things and understanding the authentic piece from a child, from the SEL piece. It's going to be different for every child that's in there. But that's one way. I took a look at cultural responsiveness was something that I had written about and understanding, you know, a child's background, their upbringing is going to impact it. Taking a look at interests and passions and strengths, it's looking mm-hmm. at the differences in our children as strengths and not necessarily as negatives. As sometimes it's, well, now I can't teach that whole group. It's how do we leverage things like interests and passions and strengths or things such as authentic feedback. And so I really tried to create what are practical ways that teachers, on one hand, have always done these things in classrooms, yeah. But to put it in a way that pulls it all together of how can we create authentic experiences so that that child's experience is unique to them in recognizing the beauty that's inside that child, whatever learning differences that they mm-hmm. might have, whatever cultural differences mm-hmm. they might have, and really recognizing the beauty in those differences.
Yeah, so beautifully stated. Thank you for sharing that. You also have, I noticed, co-authors. Mm-hmm. I think it's chapters 5 and 6, yep. am I correct?
Yep, correct.
Why? You certainly know a lot of things, Tom. Yeah.
So I started to share early with the forward with Inky wanting an experience that was very different of mine, you know, and that early on forward, Inky's growing up was a very different story than my growing up and recognizing the power in those differences. I just referenced cultural relevance, and I will tell you that I would feel very uncomfortable, nor would I be qualified to fully write a section on cultural relevance as the white male who grew up in middle-class America. Mm-hmm. It's not my story to tell in the sense of there's so much power to other stories of folks that have very different learning experiences in mind. So I open up that section with about a paragraph that basically says, as the white male that grew up in middle-class America, it's not my job to tell this piece. So I turn mm-hmm. it over to Dr. Rosa Perez Isaiah, a really good friend of mine. Her story is so incredibly different than mine. When you take a look at, she came from an undocumented family. She's now in California helping to lead and doing incredible work in there. But she really talks about things like privilege and bias and in ways that I couldn't, in ways mm-hmm. that a lens is different. Ken Shelton co-authored this section on equity barriers. Ken, as a black male, has a very different perspective on things from race. But when we look at equity, there's so many, as we work here at the Alliance, when we dive into some of these equity components, you know, Ken's lens versus mine is very different. And so I was very transparent. They're both good friends of mine, but they also have very different life experiences mm-hmm. of mine. So if I'm going to talk about things around equity or cultural relevance, it needed to be more than my lens. Mm-hmm. And so for me to authentically do that, I really needed to reach out to people who have different experiences that I do so they could authentically talk about it in a way that I just couldn't.
Mm-hmm. One of the strengths of your book, too, is mm-hmm. the formatting in which you created yes. and developed all of it. So you have these make it stick pieces, yep. literally looks like a piece of tape with yep, a post-it yep. note stuck up. You have a stop and reflect, you have an amplifying, you have a amplifying the interests, passions, and strengths in our learners, and then the practice.
Yep.
this is such a strong writing style and very practical and something you could pick up, read, put down, pick up, read down. I could see myself writing in it. Talk about this. Why was that important to you to get all of this rich, rich content across to folks?
Sure. So for me, going back to the, we'll start with the Make It Stick. So I reached out to about 50 different educators, diverse backgrounds, more females than males, just because of the lens there, and basically sent them a section and said, you know, when I wrote this section, I was thinking about you and the way that you teach and what I know about what you value. If I were to give you this, what's something you could do tomorrow in the classroom? Mm. 2 to 3 sentences. And so I wanted to balance some of the story and emotion in those pieces with, well, what do I actually do with it? Mm-hmm. One thing I know about educators, they're so tight on time and they need the practical pieces of give me something to try, give me something different. And so all 50 of those Make It Sticks are ideas from all practitioners on here's what I would do tomorrow to try this, or here's questions I would ask, here's a project that I would do. So I wanted it to be really practical in nature. At the end of each section, or most sections, I created a try this. And that was me kind of racking my brains of, if I had a teacher come to me and said, what do I do here? Here's every possible thing that I could think of to do, whether you're a kindergarten teacher or a physics teacher, again, to be really practical in that. The in practice sections, they wanted to spotlight, well, what does this look like in practice on a larger scale? And so that's where you hear from a couple superintendents or, you know, somebody that's looking at it from more of a district level end, just to see kind of big picture. And then finally, the stop and reflects are really meant for the reader. And that came from, I did a lot of sharing as I was writing to superintendents, to principals, to teachers to get feedback. And had a principal say to me, you know, one of the things that she loves to do is as she's reading, take some notes or write it. And she said, well, what if you created these areas to kind of stop and reflect as you're doing it? I said, can I steal that? Stop and reflect. She said, absolutely. To really help the author. If I was working with somebody in that section on that area, what are the questions that I would ask? What are the ways that I would ask them to pause and reflect and have that? And that's what I built in, which ultimately become the study guide questions for those folks that are doing it. So it's really meant to be an authentic way to process, to reflect, and then also be able to do something different tomorrow.
I appreciate your recognition of the tremendous gaps that we have in education. I often refer to those as opportunity gaps. And I do that purposely because sometimes I feel when we talk about achievement gaps, for example, it reflects back to the kid. I taught it, they didn't learn it. I gave this extra, they didn't take advantage of it. Whereas I refer to opportunity gaps that are so missing. And those are the opportunities that we would want for our own children that we don't always provide for other people's kids. So this year, as you are well aware, at the Alliance for Excellent Education, we have a year-long campaign around the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court case. We're highlighting the continuing needs of students, no matter their race, their zip code, or background, 65 years after Brown was declared. And 65 years later, we still have issues, and it's not a dream that became fulfilled for many. As we just referenced, you explore issues surrounding equity, first by recognizing the gaps in opportunity and access that still exist for marginalized groups, and second by identifying ways to tackle these vital issues head-on in our classrooms, and even in our schools and school systems. So what do you see as some of those challenges and opportunities, Tom, to actually address these items?
First, I think it's our own lens that often gets in the way. And being able to address and take a look at what is the lens in which we see the world. As I shared early on, I recognize my white male lens from middle class America. That's one lens. Mm-hmm. It's also very different than the experience of many others. And so one of the pieces that I would say from an opportunity end is to find people that are different than you in some way. Maybe it's gender, maybe it's race, maybe it's religion, and connect with them. I will tell you, whether it was Rosa and Ken who I referred to earlier, there's times I'll go to them and say, you know, on this issue, I never experienced this growing up. Tell me what that was like for you. Explain that to me. And I've learned in my own learning many ways through people that I have that trust that I can say, like, where's my blind spots? Where are my blinders here? Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I'll often ask educators to do is to find somebody that has differences than you on your staff or whatever the case is, and ask them to help identify some of those blind spots. Whether it's they walk into their classroom, what are the images of success around our classroom? Who do we naturally glorify in our own lens and our own bias? And ask for feedback, you know, and getting some of that feedback. But don't be hurt if they give you feedback on telling you to change things.
Yeah.
When we take a look at some of the large areas, when we take a look from an opportunity end, and I love how you share opportunity gaps instead of achievement gaps, because I couldn't agree more on that end. You know, some of the things that we talk about from an equity end that Ken and I do around, you know, opportunities for rigorous courses. There's some places out there, it's not always a socioeconomic, sometimes it's a rural issue. And, you know, here's this rural district and we want to pay you the least in the state and we want to, and we don't have an opportunity in those places. And so sometimes it's based on location and those kinds of things. But when we look at that, one of the areas we'll take a look at something like computer science. You know, I know that's one area, one metric. And if we look at one AP test, I know it's such a small segment, but when we take a look, for instance, there, like we go back to 2013. In 2013, there was in 11 states, not a single black student took the AP computer science in states. Mm-hmm. And in 8 states, not a single Hispanic student. Now, the positive is we've seen trends moving up since then. The negative is we're not need to be where we need to be in those regards. And so when we look at some of the opportunities, we have to really get to the heart of why. And the positive is educators that we see, whether it's through the work of Future Ready or the Alliance, and some other great work that's going on out there, are really trying to attack some of those opportunity gaps. We also address opportunities in access. And sometimes, mm-hmm. You know, that could be access at home, the homework gap. The Alliance has done a lot of work with that, and those kinds of things there as well. But trying to give some practical solutions. But number one, it's taking a critical look at where are our blinders and our blind spots, getting some help with that from different lenses. But then once we know, we need to do better in those areas. Because if we know that our discipline rates for our students of color are far different than for our white students or our females versus our males, and now that we know that, we need to do something about it. And then to me, it becomes a moral and ethical obligation to do it.
Right. Yeah. One of the pieces that I really appreciate at the Alliance is this big focus on what opportunities are available to all students, not just a student in a certain zip code, et cetera. And, you know, I've had a vast array of experiences to visit schools across our nation, actually even internationally. And I always ask myself one question going into that school, which is this school good enough for my own kid? Because if the answer to that is no, I still don't understand why we allow it to be okay for other people's kids. So when we think about the Alliance for Excellent Education, I just so appreciate the fact that we have an organization who's focused on equity and providing opportunities, again, that we would want for our own students. And as part of the Alliance for Excellent Education, we have a Future Ready initiative, and you are the Director of Innovation, a supreme Director of Innovation, I might add, because you're always thinking outside the big box, big circles, whatever you want to call it. So we are helping school districts to develop the human and technological capacity needed to really personalize student learning and prepare kids for college and a career and citizenship. School district superintendents play an extraordinary and key role, but certainly not the only role in the Future Ready process. So to a superintendent watching this webinar, what lesson, Tom, can they take from this book? I'm remembering a key moment in your book when you talked about Dr. Scanlon and the impact that he had on you.
So Dr. Scanlon's still a practicing superintendent in Westchester, Pennsylvania, an incredible superintendent.
So let's send out a great applause. Thank you, Dr. Scanlon.
So I refer to a time, and he might not even remember this at this point, but it was I want to say my second week teaching, and I share this story in the book. And, you know, he comes down after lunch. I had just gotten my students back from recess, and I get the door open, superintendent standing there. Hey, Mr. Murray, do you have a moment?
And you're like,
and I remember thinking, like, here's my superintendent. And I'm thinking, like, is this the go get your box conversation? Because this isn't working out. So I walk across. Kind of tell my students, hold on, thinking to myself, like, hope I see you again somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And so pulls me into the hallway and reaches his hand out, just, hey, Tom, you know, Dr. Scanlon, good to see you. I just wanted to say, I overheard something in district office, shares a real positive about something that had happened, and just said, you know, I just want to say, don't stop doing that. I'm proud of you. Shakes my hand and walks back down the hallway. And it was this 30-second or less interaction. I think I may have walked back in my room and done cartwheels in front of my kids, being like, hands up. But here it is 20 years later, and I could show you where I'm standing. And so part of what I would share with superintendents is be real, be vulnerable, but never forget where you came from.
Oh,
never
so
forget
true.
What it's like to teach that first day. You
so
know, in retrospect, that first few weeks, I was pretty clueless in retrospect. I was just trying to get, sometimes my mentors were saying, you know, well, next year, next month in the curriculum. And I'm like, next month? I'm just trying to get to lunch today to be able to do this, right? And so to not forget what it's like, not forget how difficult teaching is every single day, not forget that we ask teachers sometimes to move 130 kids at the secondary level, and they do it over the course of the year.
Right.
And so from a superintendent, and it's be real, be vulnerable, let's not forget where he came from, but also not to lose sight of their impact, you know, from a culture end, relationship end, with their community and so on. I will tell you, working through Future Ready Schools, I've met some of the most amazing educators that have superintendents on their business cards that are doing innovative things, but also don't forget why we do what we do, and that's serving kids.
Yeah. You know, it's so really amazing about that issue. is the fact that we often relate personalization to teaching and learning, but that's personalization in leadership, right? Mm-hmm. The handwritten notes that some people will take, you know, I know people who just travel with note cards, and it may be easier to send an email, but in this day of a lack of personalization, that handwritten note in, that maybe takes 3 seconds to write or maybe a minute to write means so much. And the fact that that superintendent, Dr. Scanlon, would actually come to your door, open the door to tell you that, like, that probably fueled you in ways that you never even knew possible. And yet, I've been in school districts where a superintendent or a principal may say, oh, I interact with the kids or the students all the time. And I remember walking down the hallway of a really large high school, and the superintendent had said, oh, I visit the schools all the time. And I was walking behind him as he was talking to somebody else, and there were teachers lined up at the doors. They didn't know who the superintendent was. Yeah. And I was like, oh, that's quite interesting, because he believes that he comes here routinely, or that was the story he mentioned. And yet I find the leaders who are so revered and respected are those that take that personalized time, that do not forget where they came from, as you mentioned. And that's a great bumper sticker or a T-shirt to have, right? Don't forget where you came from.
Yeah. So one snapshot behind the scenes, when I started to write the book, I really actually started out with your Chapter 5 piece as you were sharing kind of these core tenets of what personal and authentic could look like in the classroom. But the more I started to write it, the more I started to realize, well, the culture that we create is really personal and authentic if I feel like I fit part of it, and it's authentic because you can't just replicate it.
Right.
You can't just say, well, just make it happen in this building because they're all different. But then as I start to think about the best relationships we have, it's really things that are personal and authentic. And so the more I started to write in different areas, the more I really started to create, it's not just the experience, it's the interactions, it's the culture, it's even the tools where we talk about technology and spaces as they can amplify or hinder. How do we make those things that are personal and authentic in nature ultimately for the student experience on the whole?
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing. Sure. That's really critical. Just before we close, I want to ask you to talk a little bit about this fail-forward mindset that you have. It's kind of a unique phrase. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about that.
So years ago, I read a book by John Maxwell called Failing Forward. And so it's really stuck with me since then. And I think going back to sharing earlier how educators really are such perfectionists, and it comes from having high standards for themselves and for others, that it's giving ourselves enough grace to say, like, when I mess things up, it's not if when I mess things up, that I'm going to get up and keep trying. And, you know, if I'm that principal and I make that call to my faculty and things don't go well, the vulnerability of owning it, failing forward and trying again, our staff appreciates that. And one of the pieces that I had written, because I really, really believe in this area of every time we fail, it's an opportunity to get up and to keep trying for those that look to us for direction. And so if I'm a teacher in a classroom and things don't go well, when I own it and move forward, I'm modeling to my kids perseverance. When I'm a principal or superintendent doing it and I own it, it shows teachers, like, you're human, you make mistakes, you own it, you recognizing it, but to model it to fail forward and keep moving forward. And so whether it's sports, whether it's in the classroom, whether it's just in terms of in life, we're going to make mistakes, and it's recognizing that that's okay and having the vulnerability to recognize that in ourselves and in others, but saying, let's get our shoes back on, let's try it again, and let's go get it for kids.
Yeah, it's such a unique and important concept. And when I read that particular piece, I was reminded of somebody, I cannot even remember, it was so long ago, where they differentiated for me as a leader the difference between a risk taker versus a risk maker. Because when you think about it, risk taking, it's difficult, but there's always like guide rails you feel along the way. When you're a risk maker, you're actually stepping in a little bit to that unknown and feeling like, okay, I'm willing to be vulnerable and fail forward. So it's just a really important distinction. So I really want to respect that as well. We could talk on and on and on. You have touched my heart both as a leader and as a colleague and now as a friend. So Tom, I really want to thank you again for joining me today. Your book has been an inspiration for me. I'm going to read it 2 or 3 more times. I'll try to stop being teary-eyed as I read through it. And I'm sure for the many educators who have read it, but most importantly, for students, because really what you do throughout this entire book is to respect the kids whose lives you have and sometimes whose lives you haven't touched because you're vulnerable and you recognize that we're not always the best for every single person who crosses our path, but we certainly try to be the best all of the time. If you don't already have your copy of Tom's book, please visit thomascmurray.com/books to order your copy today. And on his website, Tom has also created a study guide and a variety of book study resources to provide deeper insights and thoughts into what you'll read in the book. while pointing readers to many great additional tools and resources that can support the great work happening in your school or your district. So if you happen to have a professional learning group going on, if you have book studies in your schools, please pick up a copy of Personal Authentic, and I know it's going to really enhance your practices. If you missed any of today's webinar, you can watch our archive video at allfored.org/webinars. Thank you for joining us. Have a great day, and thank you from the bottom of my heart for everything you do every single day for our kids.